This is the L3 Leadership Podcast, episode number 123. What's up, everybody, and welcome to episode number 123 of the L3 Leadership Podcast. My name is Doug Smith, and I'm the founder of L3 Leadership. We're a leadership development company devoted to helping you become the best leader that you can be. In this episode, you're going to get to hear one of my bucket list interviews. I had the privilege of interviewing Clinton Hurdle, the manager of the Pittsburgh Pirates, and it is as good as I expected it to be. Before we jump into that, if you're new to the podcast, this podcast is intended to help you grow your leadership skills, and we're committed to bringing you three episodes each month. One's always from our leadership breakfast, one's an interview with a high-level leader, and then once a month, you'll get a leadership lesson by me as well. If you've been listening to the podcast for a while, I'd really appreciate if you jump on iTunes and leave a rating and review. It really does make a difference, so thank you for that. And I also want to thank our sponsors, Babb Inc. They're an independent insurance broker on the north side of Pittsburgh, and they do business all over the country. The phenomenal company led by my friend Russell Livingston, and they host all of our leadership breakfasts. They have a huge passion for developing next generation leaders, and so I encourage you to check them out at their website or at one of our breakfasts. Their website is babbins.com. That's B-A-B-B-I-N-S.com. As I mentioned, this episode, I interviewed Clint Hurdle, the manager of the Pittsburgh Pirates. This has been on my bucket list for really since I've heard about Clint Hurdle in the first time I heard him speak. He's an incredible leader. He's so full of wisdom. He's one of the most humble people that I've met. And he's learned, and I think he's become humble because he had to learn some tough lessons along the way. But what I love about Clint is he's open and vulnerable about those lessons, and he shares them with other people. He's not perfect, and he knows that. And I think that's what makes him such a great leader, is because he's just real. And this was by far one of my favorite interviews. In the interview, we talk about Clint's favorite moment as the coach of the Pittsburgh Pirates. We talk about coaching, we talk about leadership, we talk about faith, family, and legacy. There's just so much in this. And if you're taking notes, if you're not driving, I encourage you to pull out a notebook, because there is so much gold in this interview. So that being said, let's just jump right into it, and I'll be back at the end with a few announcements. Clint, thank you so much for being willing to do this interview. Why don't we just start off with us telling, for those of you who don't know who you are and what you do.
I'm a husband. Married to Carla June Yerrick. Now Carla Hurdle. I'm the father of three children. 31-year-old Ashley lives out in San Francisco. And 14-year-old Madison, 12-year-old Christian. I'm employed by the Pittsburgh Pirates. I manage the baseball team here, have since 2011. That's kind of what I do. I'm involved. I'm a member in good standing in the Hampton Rotary Club.
Nice, nice. I was a past Rotarian, so yeah, fun stuff.
And that's, you know, I'm just like the neighbor down the street.
Yeah. Just fun question. Favorite Pittsburgh memory so far in your coaching career here, what would it be?
The play-in game in 2013, the blackout.
Why was that your favorite?
I've been fortunate. Doug. It is Doug, correct?
Correct. That's good.
Yeah. Dougie Wuggie, Maddie. I told Maddie I was going to go speak to Doug Smith today. She goes, is that the Dougie Wuggie we knew in Texas? I go, no, that was Doug Banks. That was Doug
Smith. Dougie Wuggie's fine. I love it.
Been to the World Series three times, and I've played in championship games in the National League and the American League. To get there, never game seven in the World Series. However, that particular game had more emotion, pent-up emotion. I mean, you talk about a city, a fan base, 20 years without a playoff game. 20 consecutive losing seasons, the blackout idea, the generational support we had in the stands. I heard story after story that was a grandfather, a father, and his son sitting together, and for the game to go the way it did, and then for the fans to call out Cueto and drop the ball, the next pitch is a home run. I mean, it was – I had goosebumps. And the way our city showed – up, the way our ballpark showed off, because our ballpark is a beautiful ballpark, that night it was magnificent. So for me, that's the top of the list right now. And I've been fortunate, as I said, for some different things to have witnessed and been a part of, that one is at the top of the list.
That's great. I want to spend a little bit of time talking to you about coaching and leadership. And I'm just curious, you were a player and now you're obviously a coach. Was there anything let's see how I worded this. Was there anything that you thought you knew about leadership as a player that now that you're actually in the coach's position that you wish you would have known or that you've learned over that experience?
Yes, there's many things. One thing I did when I first was given my managerial opportunity in Colorado in 2002, at the end of that season, after having managed for 4 months, I called up every former manager that I could find and apologized to them.
Nice.
And I wasn't a bad guy. However, I had no idea what the responsibilities were for a manager and how I probably at times was way more high maintenance than I should have been. Maybe I didn't plug in the way I should have. Maybe I didn't listen. Whatever it was, I just called up and said, I'm sorry. I really have a much better understanding of what you were trying to do and what you did and how you did it now, and a much greater appreciation for it. I had no concept of what I feel is the greatest separator in building trust, and that's relational time. That's not what we call FaceTime on your iPhone or your phone, your smart device, but actual FaceTime like you and I are having right here. I had no idea the importance of that, how that is the quickest way to build trust, and that, for me, is the greatest separator in a good family, in a good corporation, a good organization, and a good team.
That's fantastic. I'm just curious, along those lines, do you ever feel like you can get too relational where you're too bought into the relationships that it dissolves that line between player and coach? How do you keep maintain the respect while being a friend?
It's a great question, and it's one that I need to remind myself if I'm a coach. I share this thought with coaches that your relationship with the player, and I'm still a coach, so I fall into this category. And this is the analogy I use. And I had it shared with me one day from a former major league manager. He said, your relationship between the coach and the player is two houses in a neighborhood, side by side. They got two dogs. Everybody's got a dog. Both houses got a dog. There's a fence that separates the houses, a chain link fence. Now, those dogs can run up and down those backyards. They can hoot. They can holler. But one dog doesn't get in the other yard. There's separation of the yard, but the relationship is still close. They can lick each other through the fence. You know, they can pull a toy. And however, you keep that separation, you keep it clean, that there is a point in time where there needs to be some separation. And because you're not a player if you're a coach, and you're not a coach if you're a player. And from the managerial aspect, I do try and make sure I'm empathetic of people's personal space. And I don't need to coach up everything. I need, more importantly, to let them know that I do care about everything that happens to them. And I'm there for support at any time. And I think then, by developing that relationship we talked about earlier, then I'm going to have somewhat of an alarm system if something's a little bit out of whack in their life. And then I can just say, how are you doing? And then truly listen to how they're doing. More often than not, we throw out a how you're doing as we're walking by each other in the hallway. Not enough people stop and listen to the answer to the how you're doing. And then to take a step further to have the conversation about how you're doing.
Yeah. So it's great that you have those conversations, but then there's the part of leadership that I'm sure is probably more difficult, the hard conversations. And I'm sure you're forced to. You don't really get an option to not have tough conversations. How do you have those conversations? What skills have you developed over the years to sit a player down and look them in the eye and say, you know, you're not cutting it, or, hey, we have to let you go, or, you know, I don't know what that's like, but can you just talk about how you do that and balance that?
It truly is. I think it can be one of the best opportunities for that person to know that you, number one, you're going to be truthful. You stay with the facts. You show empathy, because I do care about the players that I send down or the coaches that I have to move, because they have families that they represent. And when you pour into people, it makes that separation or that hard, tough conversation harder. But I'm good with that because it's worth it. I don't want to be sterile and mechanical where it's business and it's just something you do. That for me would be horrible. And I don't think you get the maximum input and feedback from your employees, your personnel, whoever it might be, if there's not trust and there's not a relationship built. I tell them the truth. I don't try and soft coat it or sugarcoat it, but I say it with empathy. We just went through a very difficult situation here with three coaches. I had a staff transformation where I made some coaching changes. And I shared with them that there was no need to look anywhere other or a general manager, assistant general manager, the owner. This was presented to me on what my thoughts were, and I shared my thoughts. These are my thoughts. And I also like to believe that those conversations, it shouldn't be the first time that something that hasn't worked well is brought up. That's one thing I've learned in our industry, and I learned at a very young age, that more often than not, a firing or an assignment down, or if that's the first time you hear about where you weren't measuring up, that's really not acceptable. There's a better way to do things. And I can remember a few years ago, Josh Harrison, I think we sent Josh up and down 5 times in a season. And I can remember every time looking in the eye, I said, man, this is delay. This is not denial. I believe in you. However, that crazy little thing we call an option, you know, as long as you've got one, we can use it as many times as we need to manipulate the roster, to have roster allocation, to strengthen ourselves where we need to, whether we need more pitching or something. And you're the guy that we can spin, we're going to spin you. That's just the real part of the game, the mechanical part of the game. But I believe in you that you can go play, go down, feel what you need to feel, and get your game on and keep playing. Because not only are you playing for us, you're playing for somebody else. Truthfully, then I could usually share life experience because I've been released, I've been traded, I've been cut, I've been sent down.
So can you talk about that? So on the other end, the players that take those positions of pride of, no, you're lying, I'm better than this, or whatever, versus the ones that actually are teachable. Did you just have to have it beat into you to be teachable, or do you find the players are just... I mean, how do people grow and adapt into taking that feedback and actually doing something
with it? Everybody's different. There's some players that I listened at times, and then I think I was that kind of player that I always had a thirst for knowledge, and I always wanted to know why, and I would ask why, and that sometimes presented some complications because sometimes I had teachers that didn't want to tell me why. It was almost like, you know, you'll get in the household, well, I'm the dad, that's why. Well, that never sat with me too well. I've had some players here that what you've got to do over time, you model the behavior you want to instill in others. So I either wear them down with kindness, I wear them down with empathy. They just see that he's not going to change. That's who he is. This isn't an act. I'm going to tell them the truth. I'm going to tell them the truth when it's good truth. I'm going to tell them the truth when it's hard truth. I'm going to tell them the truth when it's bad truth for them personally, but I'm going to tell them the truth. That way, I'm honoring my position, what I need to do. I'm honoring the organization. I'm not talking out both sides of my mouth. And I always let the player know that, you know, is there a teachable moment in here for you? Is there something that you can really benefit from that maybe you haven't learned before? Maybe through this situation, you can understand that, you know what? You're not the best in the game right now. Or I use the word yet a lot. You know, you're not a major league player yet. You know, getting here is one thing. Staying here is another. That's the challenge once you get here is to stay here. Now, if you don't get to stay here and you're asked to leave to go down, find out why, what areas you might need to work on or improve upon, and go do it. And I do remind them, for the ones that aren't receptive, that, you know what? Life's not fair. Life's not fair. And you're going to get dealt adversity. You're promised it. And what that does, though, is gives you an opportunity to develop your character, your perseverance, because there is another side to come out on with the right mindset, where you will become better and you won't just be bitter over the experience.
Yeah. So can you talk about, I've heard you speak multiple times and you talked about one passion you have is just developing young men. I mean, that's one of your favorite parts of coaching, if not the favorite, I don't know. Can you talk about what are the core values that you bring into the team? And then how do you drill those down and actually get them to grow into those core values or grow them into the men that you see them potentially becoming?
Well, I think as you, if you would at all turn back the projector and watch our own life experiences from the time we were pre-teenage to teenage, adolescent to, you know, 18, when the world tells us we're an adult and we're really not.
Yeah.
Or 21, whatever the legal age is. I think that you really can't put an age-specific number on it, because my son has a better core value system in place at the age of 12 than I did probably when I was 18 already.
That's great.
He's a transformational leader. He's a servant. He has a sensitive heart. He has a lens and looks at what he can give versus what he can take. And I wrestled with that throughout life, being a giver or being a taker. And that's one thing I share with the players. And I think when you can get men, young boys, to understand that manhood is real and it's not something that you're just given, it's something that you need to earn and develop, the responsibilities that come with it, you need to find your personal why. Why do you do what you do? Why do you like it so much? What drives you? What's your motivating factor? Then how do you plug that into a team concept? And then how do you plug that into a personal concept? Are there values within a team core structure that you can also put in place in your life? Impacting others and not impacting them by getting in their way, just being a servant. That's something that I really didn't get till, my late 20s. Maybe after that I need to use my eyes and my ears much more than I need to use my mouth. I can share wisdom with my eyes and my ears by watching what other people do and then sharing some thoughts by listening to what other people say. And then when asked, share some thoughts rather than you and I sitting here and I can't wait for you to finish a question so I can talk and I don't listen to what you have to offer, what you say. It truly becomes about having no agenda, just being here to hopefully put you in a position with this podcast to share some insight on others to develop their particular skill sets or talents, to let you know by spending time with you, Doug, I hope that I'm empowering you. That you do matter, that you are significant. You didn't have to be some CEO downtown Pittsburgh to spend 45 minutes or an hour with me.
Yeah, thank you.
This is real life and real people. It's not a caste system. You don't know who you can impact on a daily basis when you just use your eyes and use your ears. It might be somebody in the hallway here at PNC. It could have been a service person over at Soho where I had lunch. Because with the position I'm in, for the people that do know, they watch how I act. They listen to what I say. Most importantly, around town, they watch what I tip. One of the downsides, as a manager, you want to make sure you tip appropriately, because if you don't, you can get to social media in a hurry.
Yeah.
And I don't want to do it in the poor fashion, just a tip to gut it. But I want to let people know I appreciate their service.
Yeah. So do you have a system like a guy comes in, or even just annually, do you guys have like weekly meetings where you just share leadership lessons, or do you just spend an hour a week with each player? I mean, what do you do intentionally to develop them?
We have an intentional time. First of all, it starts in spring training, and I will bring in external speakers. The list of guys has grown over the years. There's a young man on the West Coast named Chance Scoggins who used to write a blog, if you look him up. John Brubaker is another guy I bring in, a former lacrosse coach. John Gordon, very nationally prominent speaker. Bill Treasurer has written a couple books. I brought him in. We brought in Joe Ehrman, who wrote one of the best coaching books that I've ever read. We brought him in. So I look for different voices, the common fabric in the message. Then we'll pick particular topics where the coaching staff and I will sit down and spend some intentional time with each other. After that, once each half of the season, I'll bring each individual coach in for a 3-up, 3-down session where they'll share with me 3 things I'm doing well and 3 things that I could do better. And then we feed that down to that coach. Will have that meeting with the players. in their respective areas. And then I'll find FaceTime with each individual player. Neil and I do at the start of spring training, we call them entrance interviews. That could be 20. There are a minimum of 20 minutes with every player. Spring training, sometimes we have 60 players. We do exit interviews at the end of the season where we let them know what our focus is moving forward. We give them a recap of the season, what we thought they did well, what they thought that we could work upon. But we believe in communication, clear, clean, accurate communication. And we believe in a review portion of that communication that at the end you say, okay, you're not going to leave. I'm not letting you go until you ask me two questions about something you're still confused about, or you give me two nuggets that you're going to walk out of here that really made sense to you.
Nice.
Because one thing we do have a challenge with in society, I believe, is that messages get delivered every day. Messages aren't heard as often as they're delivered. So how can you do the best ensurement that you can do other than to ask questions at the end to make sure that the message has been heard? So we do have intentional FaceTime, and we do it systematically. We also have a scout meeting that we have every third or fourth day where I have an hour with our guys, and I'll share what I thought we did well in the last series and what I think we need to improve upon working forward. We have a meeting with a team every beginning of every series. We call it Coach Up, Coach Forward, where each individual coach has 1 to 2 minutes to share something we did well and then something we need to work on moving forward. And then I wrap it up at the end. It takes 15 minutes. So their voices need to be heard. The last thing I need to be doing is talking all the time. As a matter of fact, I usually set a mission statement for each year as far as something I'm going to improve upon. My mission statement last year was to say more by talking less. So I'm continuing to look in ways to streamline myself and the information I have and to make sure that it's, again, clean, clear, accurate, not overwhelming, not time-consuming. Because I think you and I have probably know that the average span of attention is about 15 seconds, truthfully. Yeah. Truthfully, if you don't get their attention, 15 seconds are out. And when you send an email, if it's more than the size of the phone, you've already had to establish trust because they're going to move it. They're either going to delete it or they're going to move it to continue reading. And more often than not, if it's one, two, and if it's that third one, there's a good chance you're out. I mean, this is things that I read a lot.
Yeah.
And I look for people that research things and try and stay current and stay up to speed on this, the millennials, as well as the generations that have come before them. I'm an older generation. And I've got some guys in there that I'm old enough to be their grandfather, let alone their father. So I've got to find ways to stay current without trying to be hip.
Yeah.
Just so I'm aware of the distractions they have in today's society, the things that are going on in their life that are important that may not have been important at my age, you know, when I was their age.
Yeah.
So I'm aware.
So last few questions on coaching. Where do you see, you've been pointing young leaders for years, where do you see them missing it most often where you're like, man, I see everyone, this keeps tripping them up over and over and over again to cause them to miss out on their potential?
It's, well, we all, I think when we get into leadership, it's the thirst for knowledge. And one of the things I was shared a long time that made all the sense in the world that I continue to hold on to, it's not how much I know, it's what my students know, what I'm able to learn them. I've got to be able to peel back the layers to give them information that's purposeful, intentional, useful, and time sensitive for what's going on right now. And we all can get poured into just accumulating knowledge. It's about acquiring books. I mean, fortunately, usually the books I leave on my desk, I've read. And then I'll move them off when I get a new book. But it's not just about accumulating books. It's not just about reading blogs. I keep like six people in that I get a weekly blog or a weekly report from that I read. I can't do 20.
Yeah.
You know, I use James Clear. I use Chuck Swindoll. I have some faith-based guys that I read religiously. Charles Stanley, Chuck Swindoll, Rick Warren, John Eldridge. Those are my four faith-based guys. James Clear is a guy. John Gordon's a guy. John Brubaker's a guy. That's about the gist of my guys that I pull from every week. There's seven of them. Four faith-based, three are informational, current. Dr. Kevin Elko, sorry, eight. Those are the people that have sharpened me and continue to sharpen me.
Well, while you're on that, it's a question I have later. What books do you find yourself giving away most often or gifting or that you would? What are your top five or couple?
Normally starting off, it's that read. It's that purposeful read that talks about a young man thinking he's got it all together, then it all falling apart, and then find a way to redefine himself. And there's a lot of those books out there. I think because we all can relate to failure much more than we can excellence initially. And then you work your way up to Colin Powell's biography. I mean, because it's an impactful book. It's sure. Awesome.
Yeah.
But I couldn't have read that at the start of my leadership journey.
Yeah.
John Wooden. I couldn't relate to John Wooden at the start of my leadership journey. The pyramid of success, what? And then the way all the there's a stone in every, there's a block in every pyramid. It all makes sense now. Wooden is at the top of all those lists, both those lists. And I send out a weekly message from John Wooden. It's called Wooden's Wisdom. I call it Wooden Wednesday. And it's classic. It's timeless. It's genius because of its simplistic nature. However, it's deep-rooted servant's mentality. More often than not, we're in a hurry to be a leader. It takes time. It takes patience and it takes courage because most leaders don't realize how lonely it's going to be along the journey as well. Sometimes you get more caught up in who's following me, the number of likes you have, the number of subscribers you have, the number of people that are tuned into what you're saying. That doesn't work for me either. However, the one thing I re-identify with all the time, I can't lead anywhere if I'm not leading at home first. And that is my go-to. And that's why I'll have a one-up, one-down with my wife. I have a one-up, one-down with my kids every couple of weeks. What's daddy doing well? What does daddy need to stop doing? Is there something I need to stop doing? Is there something I can do better? We have those conversations at home because if I'm not leading at home, I should not be even attempting to lead anywhere else.
Do you have any strategies for how do you balance faith work? I mean, you're on the road a lot of the year. How do you actually maintain your family while holding the schedule you have?
More often than not, at least every other day, I wake up and call my kids before they go to school. And it can be challenging. If I'm on the West Coast and they're leaving at 7:20, you know, I get up at 4 o'clock and I call them and I talk to them for 15 minutes. I go back to bed. My wife and I find time where we can just talk about what we need to talk about. I find different ways, you know, whether it's FaceTime on a phone, can that kind of FaceTime is usable, can be appropriate. I'll send them a small little easy text for the kids. I'll send them a picture. I just find ways to continue to plug into what they're doing. Maybe it's a joke. It can be a picture of the mascot and the visiting city we're in and a little story that goes along with it. Whatever it is, I just find ways to continue to let them know they're on my mind. I'm thinking about them. Here's what happened to dad today. Here's what dad found funny. And we knock out that time. We put that at the top of the list. I don't try and jam that into my itinerary.
That's good. So your position has provided you influence. It's also provided you financial money. So I'm curious, what have you learned about the two? You know, you see someone at a get-go probably every day, and you can either duck your head and look down and say, dear God, here's another person I have to interact with. How do you view using your platform for the good of the city? And then two, just what have you learned about money and even watching players use it? You know, everyone young thinks, oh, if I made as much as a manager of the Pirates made, then I'd have it made. Can you just talk about those two things?
Well, number one, I don't drop my head and try and walk by anybody. I don't. I don't because I look at them. there's many times they'll duck their head and drop by me because some don't even know who I am. Some people don't want an interaction with another person. However, the ones that we do lock in and make eye contact, some of them want to say hello. Some of them want to thank me. Some of them want to give me a lineup. Some of them want to complain. Some of whatever it is, but I give them that opportunity because people want attention. And some people just want to say hello. And some people want to just pat me on the back and encourage me. So I give them that opportunity. Does it sometimes make my visit a little long? Yeah, but that's okay. Because truthfully, at the end of the day, there's nothing more valuable than we can give anybody than our time. It's the most valuable gift we can give anybody. Whether it's a minute, 5 minutes, an hour. The value of money, it's been, my wife and I have this conversation. We're not any happier right now than we were. And we've been married 17 years. We dated for 8. We're not happier now than we were when we first met. Our lives have changed. We have some different options. We live in a bigger house. We do drive some nicer cars. We give away more money than I ever thought I would ever give away. I didn't think I'd give away any money. You know, the tithing we do, the donations that we make, we're blessed. We want to share our the blessings because it's, from my perspective, the house, it's God's. Everything we're renting, the money I get right now, it's a blessing. Share it. Spread it around. Spread the love. I love seeing the joy on other people's faces when we can provide a monetary gift that makes a significant difference along the way, whatever that might be. One of the things my kids love to do is to go in a restaurant and pick up somebody's tab anonymously. They have trouble with the anonymous part. My daughter does. She wants people to know, my son, we're good. It's just, we'll pick somebody out. I'll let them pick somebody out.
I love that.
And then we just move on. People also don't realize that I live check to check until the age of 40, gosh, what was it, 2002, 43 years old. And unfortunately, I made some decisions that didn't work out. I was divorced twice. I'm a recovering alcoholic. I never worried about money, though, through all this either. I mean, I just had it. I made it. I had to give it back. I had to give it away. I had to share it. However, I did live check to check until I became manager of the Rockies. That was the first time where I was able to start really saving some money. When you have a child from another marriage, you have two ex-wives, you know, you split things up, you share things. There's the one of the greatest things that have come to the realization I didn't understand all the time. One of the greatest sayings that has ever shared with me is that, you know, God loves us so much, he gives us the freedom of choice. He also loves us so much, he doesn't let us pick the consequences of our bad choices. You know, we want to choose the consequences as well when we make that choice. That doesn't happen. We don't get to pick those consequences of our bad choices. And I made some choices that weren't good.
Yeah.
So I probably have a greater, deeper appreciation for what money isn't than what money is.
I love that. Can you talk about praise and criticism? So I'm assuming as a leader, you need to somewhat become dead to both, right? Because one minute you can be the town's hero. The next minute they want you out of here. How have you learned to handle that over your career, whether that's as a player, coach, et cetera? Because that has to be, you're on the paper every day, radio, et cetera.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think you've got to have a sense of humor. And I also realize that, you know, I say it sometimes publicly in jest, and there's some deep hidden meaning to it. Everybody in town can do my job better than me. And I don't say that cynically or sarcastically. It's just part of what I do. I get second guessed when we win. I get second guessed when pretty much everything went well. I know I'm never going to manage a perfect game. I can't make everybody happy. I know that going in. First and foremost, everything I do and say is the glory of God. That's the ultimate test, the ultimate litmus test, my ultimate fan base. There's no hidden agenda. I'm not leveraging my situation. I believe I'll manage in that chair as long as God wants me there. No man can move me. And when God wants me out of that chair, no man can keep me there. I believe that with all my heart. There's people that are always going to have opinions or thoughts. And we live in a society that the sensationalism of sport is a freakishly wonderful thing for many. It does give them an opportunity to share, vent, hear themselves. I'm good with all that. I just don't read it. And I don't plug into it. Because I do know this about human emotion. If I read it, it will take me somewhere. If I listen to it, it will take me somewhere. You hear praises, you think you're pretty good. You hear criticism, you want to fight. So I just unplug. I don't. I have the people that I really believe I need to listen to. I have a truth posse. I have a Mount Rushmore group of four people in my life that are all but ones older than me, that are a lot more experienced than I am, that have had positions of elevated positions in corporations or organizations that have had to deal with criticism and grandeur and great success and disappointment. They share wisdom with me. They share truth with me. They keep me on a level keel. We talk about anything, anytime. We're all accessible to each other 24/7. It's not a relationship or a group that's taken for granted. That's why we call it a Mount Rushmore group. That's why I call it my Mount Rushmore group. They're people I depend upon for balance and truth. I let Jimmy Tredinich read everything, or Dan Hart, our two PR guys. And I let have them give me feedback from time to time. I don't need to read the articles when I'm interviewed because I know what I said. They might read them to make sure what I said. Sometimes I could sit with you an hour and we could talk about a number of subjects. And then you write a story based on two comments that I made, two questions. You can. It happens.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It happens a lot. And it could be on one topic that I've said four or five empowering things. However, the two things that were grabbed, that's out of my control. I give it to God. I know my heart's intent. I know the time I've spent with people and what I've said to them. The criticism part of it, I just know it comes with the position I'm in. And that I can't make everybody happy. I need to work hard to make the people that are most important to me happy. I need to represent the organization in the best light I can professionally and personally. I encourage our players to do that. Keep your name in the sports page, nowhere else in the paper. I represent a family, that name on the back. It's my wife, it's my daughter, my son, my mom and dad that I represent. So it's all very important to me. I take my job seriously. I don't take myself too seriously.
I love that. Before we get into the last two personal questions, two things. One, can you talk about failure? So I love how vulnerable you are about failed marriages. You're an alcoholic for years. Can you just talk about, one, I guess the importance about being vulnerable because we all mess up. And then two, what have you learned about failure that young leaders should know because they're going to fail?
If you're not coming up short in something, you're not reaching far enough. There's no telling what we could accomplish if we just set our goals a little bit higher. If you keep nailing your goals, maybe you're not stretching yourself enough. And I believe everybody loves a story, number one. We all love to be told a story. Number two, we identify with failure much better than we do success because each of us has misstepped sometime point in their life, or there could be a kid that's come from a broken home. My daughter's going to come from a broken home. My daughter, Ashley, it's 31. She's had that experience. There's life lessons that she's learned. I let people know where I believe I made my mistakes, what I did to correct my mistakes, and what I've done moving forward. Because the final chapters are going to be the best chapters. God is such a forgiving God. However, he doesn't want the same mistake over and over. Nobody does. So you make a mistake, you admit it, you correct it, you apologize, and you move on and learn from it. And that's what I've tried to do in the areas that I've had my missteps. Also to help other people understand that, look, other people have done what you've done and gotten through it and pushed through it. That doesn't mean failure for me. It's an event. It's not a person.
Can you just talk quickly about the importance that, or how does faith play a role in what you do on a day-to-day basis?
It's the essence of everything I do. I do believe that I have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, and that has made all the difference in the world for me. It's impacted my life. It's given me a sense of my why. If you look through the Bible, the 12 disciples, you want to talk about failures, grab each one of them individually, and there's a horror story in there somewhere. God loves taking a broken man, a flawed man, and helping him find his way back and then being used for his glory. And when we can find that way to take our brokenness and turn it into his through his forgiveness, and then push back out there with his strength and to live his will for my life, not my personal will, not my gain, but to serve in whatever capacity he thinks I'm capable of serving. To be the best husband I can be, to be the best father I can be, to be the best friend I can be, to be the best son I can be, to be the best manager I can be, my day's full.
Yeah.
I don't have a lot of time to get all caught up into me. There was times in my life that I shared this morning, the smallest package in the world is a man wrapped up in himself. And that was me for a number of years. If we were in a relationship, Doug, I'd be your friend.
Yeah.
I'd make sure it was a win in there for me somewhere, though, too. I'd help out, but I was into leveraging things. What could I get out of it? Well, truthfully now, unconditional love, the love that Carla and I have been able to develop because of our relationship with Jesus. Also, you know how much Jesus loved us? He gave us a daughter with special needs. And I know some people look at that's not a, she's been nothing but a blessing. Oh, it's hard. Trust me, there's days we didn't sign up for this that we look at each other. Those are the days I need to pick her up or she picks me up. We compliment each other. We figure it out together. God loves us so much, he gave us the responsibility of caring for that child. He loves us just as much, he gave me a 12-year-old son. Loves me so much, he put Carla in my life at a very pivotal time. I mean, I live with this woman. We had a relationship for 6 years. I asked her to marry me. She said no. I think that ever shared the story with you, Verbi? She said no. And I said, she goes, that's a very interesting question. She didn't say no. She said, that's a very interesting question. I go, well, that's not the answer I've grown accustomed to over the years. Nice. And she basically looked me in the eye and told me that until you find a way to make yourself happy, Clint, you'll never be able to make me happy. That's when I went on my wilderness trial. I went back and I went old school with my development. What was I doing well? What wasn't I doing well? I realized I couldn't find where being a drunk played out anywhere in the Bible where that was a good character reference or a good character trait to have. So I recommitted my life to Christ. You heard me share that the other night. I mean, and then I went and got some help with my drinking problem. And it's amazing what has spun off all those two decisions. Because that's where it started. I recommitted my life to Christ.
Love it. Last two questions. If you can go back and have coffee with 20-year-old Clint Hurdle, what would you tell him?
Interesting enough, if you'll go online, Stephen Nesbitt wrote an article similar to this question.
Okay.
It was a letter to my former self.
Interesting.
And it's actually in a format, in a thing called the Players Tribune. It's online.
I'll include a link. Yeah.
Players write from time to time. Joe Theismann wrote one of the best. There was another basketball player that wrote a fantastic one. It might have been Michael Jordan. Joe Theismann's was awesome. Dwight Gooden wrote one that was awesome. But I wrote one, and it was about, you know, what would I tell him? Find a way to make yourself happy first. Because I got caught up in trying to please too many people. And I did realize that the one thing that would come from that is you wouldn't please anybody.
I love that. And then one day, looking back on your life, what would you want your legacy to be? What would you want your kids to say about you at your funeral?
The thing I wanted my kids to say was he was a great dad. He was there for us. And we have a term we use here in this organization that I work on and fight for every day. It's be where your feet are. You know, for 50 minutes here, I tried to pour into you. No distractions. I'm not on a phone. I'm not looking at my clock. I'm not. That's one thing that I've gotten better at over the years, and I still have room for improvement. When I multitask, I'm multi-mediocre. I'm best served when I do one thing at a time and pour myself into it, especially with a person. And then with a task. But I'd like my kids to say, my dad, he was my dad. He was there for us. Because you know what? At the end of the day, they don't care how many wins and losses there are on my record. Winning a Manager of the Year award, yeah, that's not – how about a Dad of the Year award?
Yeah. And then how can we personally just – if someone's listening to this, how can we be praying for you on a daily basis, or can we do anything to serve you?
Yes. Remain steadfast in my faithfulness, my service. To not get caught up in worldly views, to not get caught up in external noise, to stay true to the core value, biblical values of service, and to make sure that I use my eyes and my ears so I can have empathy for other people, what they're feeling. And then just find a way to bring, you know, one thing that's been nice about this job over 6 years is to see the joy we've been able to bring to all the people that are in Pittsburgh now, our baseball fans, employees. Can you imagine what it's like to sell season tickets now versus what it was like 15 years ago?
Yep. Yeah.
But to bring joy at so many different levels in so many different areas and to know that's important.
Yeah.
That to me is now that's making a difference.
Yeah. Well, you've brought great joy to me for doing this interview. Good. I appreciate it. Thank you. That was, I took 6 pages of notes, I think so. Really appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome.
Hey everyone, thank you so much for listening to my interview with Clint. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. You can find ways to connect with Clint in the show notes at l3leadership.org, episode number 123. And if you want to stay in touch with us and everything we're doing with L3 Leadership, you can go to our website and sign up for our email list at l3leadership.org, and you'll also get a free copy of my ebook, Making the Most of Mentoring, which is my step-by-step process for how I get meetings with leaders. I want to thank our other sponsor, 068, a company led by my friend Daniel Bull, and they actually start companies with ex-convicts, and they have another company that hires ex-convicts doing unbelievable work. I encourage you to check them out at 068.org. I recently interviewed Daniel for the podcast, and that's episode 122 if you want to listen to that and listen about the work that they do. As always, I encourage you to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. It really helps us grow this podcast organically, so I thank you for that. And as always, I like to finish with a quote, and I thought it was fitting to quote John Wooden, and he said this. He said, "Success is peace of mind, which is a direct result of the self-satisfaction in knowing that you did your best to become the best you are capable of becoming." And I love that definition of success. Just do your best to be your best, and everything else will take care of itself. Thank you so much for listening and being a part of L3 Leadership. My wife, Laura, and I appreciate you so much, and we'll talk to you next episode.